It is Friday, of course. That means our big Friday interview. Actor, comedian, writer, professional traveller, playwright, and indeed much more. Michael Palin might be 72 years old, but he shows no sign of slowing down, as he told Stephen when they spoke earlier this week.
Well, it's always a challenge somewhere, just living a daily existence. When you're 72 is also a challenge, and there are lots of things ahead.
Yeah, I guess there was a serious tone to my question there in terms of when you've done all that, do you not want to slow down?
Well, you know, it's all part of my general attitude to life. If there are opportunities out there, grab them. And that's really why I got myself into this rather complicated and completely sort of kind of inconsistent life of writing this, that, and the other, and travelling and one thing and another, was by just being curious and saying, oh, well, that sounds interesting, have a go at it. And I think I still feel the same, but I mean, I'm less competitive now about what I do. I don't feel I've got to do it because someone else did it. But I look out the window as I talk to you and I think, hey, well, you know, there's something out there, someone I want to meet, there's someone somewhere I want to go. So the old appetite for work is still there.
So how competitive were you in your younger years? Like, obviously you must have been driven, but like, would you have taken anyone out to make it number one?
Taking anyone out. John Cleese is always bigger than me. No, it was just like looking over your shoulder and seeing what other people were doing, you know? And for instance, when Python ended, John went to do Fawlty Towers, Terry Jones and myself kind of had to think quite carefully about what we were going to do. And you had to, you know, he'd done a series, so we had to do a series. It turned out to be Ripping Yarns in the end, which is very different from his. In the 80s, when I was making films, I made a film of my own called The Missionary. Yeah. What was I going to do next? You know, so what were other people doing? What was the next kind of film to do? Which was the way to go? An acting role or a writing role? Or should I direct? All these various things. And I was very much conscious of what others were doing before I made my own decision.
And does that mean, Michael, that if you put pressure on yourself like that, looking back on it now, you maybe don't enjoy it as much as you should have done at the time?
Well, I always put, there was always pressure because, I don't know, I mean, I'm not the sort of person who is kind of wildly extrovert and rushes out and knocks people to one side and says, me, me, me. Everything I do, I kind of think about and I try and make it good, whether it's a book or whether it's a television series or whatever. And that brings a lot of uncertainty, I think, until you've actually got involved. One just hopes that one's choice of material, how you do it, will bring a good result at the end. And that's what's the pattern of the things I've done. There's always a bit of doubt. There's always a bit of uncertainty at the beginning. There's always that feeling of, should I be doing this, shouldn't I? Then you jump into it, and then by the end, hopefully, you say, well, what was all the fuss about? That was great. That's the ideal scenario. And that's happened most times. I don't regret much I've done, and I felt stimulated and quite sort of excited by some of the things I've been able to do.
Hello, I wish to register a complaint. Hello, miss?
What do you mean, miss?
Oh, I'm sorry, I have a cold. I wish to make a complaint.
Sorry, we're closing for lunch.
Never mind that, my lad. I wish to complain about this parrot what I purchased not half an hour ago from this very boutique.
Oh, yes, the Norwegian Blue. What's wrong with it?
I'll tell you what's wrong with it. It's dead. That's what's wrong with it.
No, it's resting. Look.
Look, my lad, I know a dead parrot when I see one, and I'm looking at one right now.
Well, you 10 nights at the O2 last year.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was true or not, which is why I'm asking you. The press were reporting that you did that to cover the 800 grand lawsuit costs. Was all that true?
That was one of the things, yeah. That was probably what sort of swayed it finally. I mean, Cleese always said, well, he's had to pay off his alimony, and Terry Jones said, well, I did it because I had to pay off my mortgage. But we had a lawsuit as a result of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and the costs of any lawsuit at all are always enormous. And so there was a certain amount of need to restock the Python kitty, which Python hadn't been organized particularly well before that. So we got a new manager, and somebody said, well, you know, if you want to pay off your debts or pay off any costs. Just do a night at the O2. And he was he's somebody who had sort of managed Queen and groups like that. So he thought big. And the one night turned into 10.
How scary is a lawsuit?
Well, I've been involved in 3 with Python in my time. One of them was in America in 1976 when Terry Gilliam and myself appeared in the American federal courthouse to try and stop ABC television putting out a digested, cut and censored version of Monty Python. They acquired 6 shows and they were busy butchering them. And I mean, that was odd because I don't think anybody ever, ever conceived of somebody actually going to court to try and stop a program going on one of the big American networks. But that was our bag. We were doing very well in America on public broadcasting. And that was, you know, that was quite scary, but not a huge amount of money involved. The second one was over the life of Brian and Channel 4 and various sort of agreements of screenings and all that, which went our way. This one involved a little more time in court, and because I was the one who had written a diary, and because this went back to 1974, I was the main witness, and that was quite that's hard. I mean, I'd really not been grilled like that before.
Is it like, because I've never actually seen it in real life? Is it like what we see on TV? Is it aggressive?
Yeah, it is aggressive. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if it's also quite theatrical, you know, the both sides sort of tell you, oh, well, you know, we know so-and-so, he'll ask you this. Just keep very level-headed, he'll try and get you rattled on this. And others say, you know, well, just go straight for it. What they really like is a bit of attack. So you don't quite know if it's slightly sort of, as I say, a drama, which you're part of. But to be consistently disbelieved for 3 hours in the witness box is hard work.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about travel and the many travel shows you've done, because as I get older now, I'm slightly mad. I think we're all mad, actually. But I find it very difficult to settle down in my own head until a few years ago when I started to travel.
Yeah.
And it just does so much, without me sounding too cheesy about it, for my soul.
Yeah.
It does. Yeah. I found this place, Santa Monica. There's a street in Santa Monica, 3rd Street. I call my company after that now.
Really? Yeah. And in Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just traveling around the world for me, now that I've got a little bit of money to be able to do it, is the most refreshing thing I think I will ever do in my life.
Well, I'd sort of go along with that. I think mentally it's very good. You have to think slightly outside the box. You have to look at different places through different eyes. You have to adjust to different ways of life. Physically, it's quite demanding. You've got to get around. You've got long plane flights. Then you've got to walk. You've got to scramble up hills and mountains and tracks and all that. But I think the combination is wonderful and good for the soul. I think you're absolutely right there.
3 mountain ranges meet here: the Himalaya, the Hindu Kush, and the Karakoram. And the Indus meets the Gilgit and begins its long journey down to Karachi. And it's also my first time next to the Karakoram Highway.
I don't know, this may sound silly, but I just don't trust the vehicles.
Whoa.
So I'm just going to try walking myself. Main thing is just not to look down and keep going. Wow, what a ride.
Where's your favourite place in the world?
Well, my favourite place is home, really. That's where I was sort of most pleased to see when I fly back from different parts. But I rather enjoy Latin America, and I enjoyed coming up through South America, and I very much enjoyed a recent journey to Brazil. That was largely because there's something in the Brazilian soul which I kind of felt was very refreshing for a North European, you know, a warmth that they have, and a feeling of enjoying life, which is a very unselfconscious. We're rather self-conscious about enjoying life. We're not quite sure whether we should be anyway.
Can I ask you about your dad? Because I read that you said in an interview, I couldn't say I was frightened of him, but I never felt totally comfortable with him. What was that about?
Well, he was always... my dad had a stammer, which was quite serious, and I think that's obviously affected his life, coloured his life, and it made him slightly testy and a bit cantankerous every now and then. He had been, you know, golden boy in the 1920s, been to university, been to Cambridge, got an engineering degree, went out to India, started building dams, came back, married my mum, big society wedding, it was all great. And then suddenly the Great Depression happens and there's very little work around, and he ends up leaving his beloved Norfolk and the South and going up to Yorkshire and ending up in Sheffield. I just think he felt pretty exhausted by the whole experience, by living through two world wars and a major depression. And so he was wary, he was cautious.
Was he loving?
Yes, I think he was loving. I mean, yeah, I think he was quite proud of me, but he was also someone who would to point out faults, you know, if he wanted to. Or if you'd had a bit of a success, he might say a little bit of, oh, well, you know, so that was easy.
Did he tell you he was proud of you?
What?
Did he tell you he was proud of your success?
No, he never told me he's proud of my success. He wouldn't use that direct. We didn't talk to each other so directly. Wow. But I think he was. He was very, really pleased when I got into, I got to work to the school he'd been to at Shrewsbury, and then I got into Oxford. But even when I got into Oxford, you would far rather I'd gone to Cambridge for some reason. So there you go.
Would it not have been important to you? Did it have any impact on you that your dad, for you being so successful, didn't say it out loud?
Two things. One is that my mother provided all the security and warmth that maybe was lacking in my father. And so I didn't feel that I wasn't getting my just desserts. And I think she and I were aware that he was, you know, he was... That's the way he was,
yeah.
And we accepted that. And although he wouldn't say he was proud of me, there were definite times when I knew that he really was, and I was happy about that, and that made me feel comfortable, yeah.
Brian, the babe they called Brian.
Throw him to the floor. What's it? Throw him to the floor. Oh, ah!
Brian, sir.
Brian, eh?
No, Brian.
Strike him, Centurion, very roughly.
It's amazing the different turns and twists in life that dictate your destiny. And I do just wonder, when I think of someone like you, would you have got away with life of Brian in this current climate today? So fast forward a couple of decades. Would you have got away with it?
Well, I mean, I don't want to talk like a politician, but we probably wouldn't have written it now. It's difficult to know. I mean, the life of Brian was about the Christian religion. So, I mean, so long as we didn't touch on the life of Muhammad, I think we'd probably been all right.
Imagine if you had have done. Imagine doing that in the life of Muhammad.
Yes. I mean, I think that to do a similar thing for the Muslim religion we wouldn't have done it for a start, because it wasn't part of our world. Whereas the Christian religion and the Bible story we were all brought up with. I think it would be difficult to do it now.
And I guess, Michael, that's the gripe that some Christians have, that they feel, be it with material like yours or others, that they feel Christianity is up for ridicule and other religions aren't. Do you have any sympathy for that?
Well, I mean, that's the way people feel. Of course, I think they're perfectly good people leading very good lives who may feel that way. I think that anybody with a sense of humour and with a slightly broader, one more tolerant way of looking at life would have no problem with the life of Brian. So I think it's a kind of, the people who think we're ridiculing Christianity, I think we're missing what it was all about, which clearly wasn't about Jesus, who we all admire, and no Python would disagree with anything Jesus did. It was all about the way religion had been hijacked by authority and by false messiahs and all that sort of thing. And I think that says a lot more about the organization of religion, which is a very, very different thing from believing in Jesus and all that. So I think that I have sympathy in the sense that tolerate anyone's right to say what they want. But I thought it was a short-sighted view, those who felt it was ridiculing the Christian religion, which is, after all, that has been in going for 2,000 years and ought to be able to deal with things like that.
Is Python the thing you're most proud of during your career?
I would say I'm proud of having produced television travel programs which have, in a sense, opened the world to a lot of people. I think that's to me, as important as Python. I mean, Python was at its best. We did some wonderful things. It was great comedy, and it was wonderful to do. The travel shows that I did, I think, showed a side of the world which was summed up for me by an Ethiopian guy I happened to meet on the street in London. He said, "Aren't you Michael Payne?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, we really enjoyed your shows about Ethiopia." And I said, "Well, that was great, and we loved going to your country." And he said, "The reason we enjoyed it was because you didn't do Ethiopia because there was a famine or because there were floods or because there was a war. You just happened to be travelling through it, and you saw life as it was." And I think that's what I was able to do and what we were able to do at the best when we did the travel program.
Talking about war, Michael, we see a lot of the world and war on our new screens at the moment over the refugee crisis. Mm. Do you think this country should be taking in more refugees?
I think that we have to be helpful to the refugees. And I think we should be... We're certainly doing as much as we are at the moment, and
are we doing enough?
I don't think we are. I think we could always do more, but I think
that's a bit of a politician's answer, though, isn't it? We could always do more. Should we be doing a lot more, or actually, should we be looking after ourselves and protecting our borders?
Oh no! I think absolutely not. We have a long tradition of welcoming refugees, particularly. Political refugees, and I think a lot of the people who are being displaced at the moment have come from horrific lives. It's like you see the pictures of Syria on television, and the sort of people who are coming out, it's like people jumping out of a blazing building. I mean, there's no place to live, and I think we have got to give them an alternative, and if that means us taking in more, yes, absolutely.
What impact did 3-year-old Aylan, when he lay on that beach dead, have on you when you saw that image?
I thought that was the most incredibly moving image, particularly with the policeman or the soldier who was picking him up. There was something about eternal loss there, about waste. And I think that I've got grandsons, so of course it made a sort of impact on me. But at the same time, I think it's certain images at certain times work, but they also remind us that this has been going on for 5 years, the war in Syria. There have been equally ghastly wars and horrible things going on in Africa and India, and certainly, in our own streets, we can hear, what's been going on in places like Rotherham and exploitation of children and all that. But certain images do concentrate the mind, and I think this concentrated the mind on the plight of refugees, which is very, very important.
Michael, there's a fair amount of criticism of the media at the moment, and I'm getting a lot of flack at the moment too, because there are some people in this country think that what we're doing is using images of the likes of Aylan and the refugees to emotionally overload people in this country into a guilt trip to care about people elsewhere rather than looking after British people.
So well, I think
the media can be very powerful when it wants to be, can't it?
Yes, it can. I mean, the media can choose photos, whatever it wants, things happening here, things happening abroad, and just highlight a certain photo. But I think there are certain moments when a photo does reflect a conflict or a struggle which has never been summed up in quite the same way before, however horrific it is. I'm thinking of Vietnam and the napalm bomb and the girl running up the road sort of with her skin melting, how incredibly profound that was. It just sort of focuses people on what's happening in reality out in places like that. If you want to ignore that, if you want to pretend it's not happening and say, well, let's just look after ourselves, then, I mean, that's that's up to you. There was nothing rigged about the photo. It actually happened, that photo on the beach with the child. And I think it's just one of many images, but it's the one that, for particular reason, I think because of the little child itself, the fact he was dressed and the fact he was sort of ready for a new life, and it ended like that, has a profound influence. I think that's the sort of thing that people should get angry and upset about.
Are you optimistic in general, Michael, about the world, or do you think it's falling apart when we think of the wars and the strife that's currently going on, and what's happening in Europe?
I'm optimistic, and I read figures recently from somebody saying that the amount of the deaths in civil violence around the world in wars actually sort of has fallen over the last few years. I feel that I'm optimistic because when I travel the world, I meet people, and a lot of the people I meet have exactly the similar hopes and ambitions as people in my own country. They want to bring their children up, like that little boy on the beach, and want them to have a good life. They want to build them a better home. And these are things which we all share. Unfortunately, there are people out there, a lot of them, I have to say, very young. They're between 18 and they're about 25. They're given guns. They're told to fight. They go out, and they love just sort of causing trouble. And I think that's this is what happens. The majority of the people out there, I think, see more that unites us than disunites us. But unfortunately, there are going to be people who will use weapons to reinforce a religious belief or a political belief or strengthen a border or whatever. And you'll always have people of violence. One just has to hope you chip away gradually at what creates this violence in the first place.
So you're going to be touring the UK over the next couple of months with this one-man show celebrating 30 years covered by three volumes of diaries.
Yeah.
How often did you keep a diary?
Well, I write the diary every day, usually. I mean, not quite every day. But I always try and keep a notebook of what's going on and write a diary, usually most mornings, yeah.
You did your first one-man show ever in Belfast, wasn't it?
That's true, in 1981 at the Arts Theatre, thanks to the wonderful Michael Barnes, who then ran the Belfast Festival. He wrote me a wonderful letter and said, you know, if you haven't done a one-man show before, please can I persuade you to come over here and try and do it. And I came over, and I'd never done a one-man show, so I realised that you had to do work very fast. I had all sorts of costume changes and all that, and it was quite elaborate. And I got to the end of the show, and it was about 36 minutes. Supposed to be about 2 hours.
So you ran out of material?
So I ran out of material. So I said to the Belfast audience, look, please, we'll just go and have a drink, come back, and then we'll have a chat together. And that's really the spirit of the shows that I still do. It's very much me and the audience, but I depend on them really to keep me
now,
going.
That is scary in my view. That is scary in my view. You and the audience, you run out of material at some stage, or you're depending on a good audience that'll work with you.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a leap of faith, but it's never let me down so far. Touch wood.
Well, look, we look forward, Michael, to you coming to Belfast. It's soon, isn't it?
It's
end of October.
I'll be in Belfast. I think it's at the very end of October.
October 30th, I'm told.
It's the end of of my tour. So, where I first started my one-man show, I'll be ending my last one-man show. That's great.
Real pleasure to talk to you today, Michael.
And
really
you
interesting.
Too.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, Stephen, thanks a lot. Bye now.
Hello, Mother.
Don't you hello, Mother, me. What are all those people doing out there?
Oh, well,
come on, what have you been up to, my lad?
I think they must have popped by for something.
You're only making it worse for yourself.
Look, I can explain.
Now, you listen here. He's not the bazaar. He's a very naughty boy.
Priceless sketches there, the one and only legendary Michael Palin in conversation with our own Stephen there. I should say that Michael's tour, in fact, starts next week. He's in Belfast Waterfront Hall on October the 30th.